Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the successful blurring of the line between news and fake news and propaganda that Stephen Bannon and the Trump campaign have employed so far, and look into how they will manage the press once they are in the White House. Having played by their own rules so far, the press has given Trump $5 billion worth of free media without him suffering any real scrutiny from them, certainly when it comes to his tax returns, and in return he has given limited access to Fox News only and no press conferences, all the while threatening the press, insulting them, and inciting his followers to attack them as he threatens to change the libel laws to sue them into submission. An award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, Mark Feldstein, a professor and chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland, joins us to discuss whether, as Trump continues to play by his own rules, the press will be able to have access to him, let alone be able to hold him accountable. Then we'll assess the fallout from the recent diplomatic upset Israel suffered at the UN Security Council, where the U.S., which has routinely shielded the Jewish state from international condemnation by using its veto, for once abstained in a 14-0 vote. Shibli Tlahami, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who was recently a senior advisor to the State Department on Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, joins us to discuss further tensions expected from an upcoming speech by Secretary of State Kerry, while the White House continues to incur the wrath of Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose ambassador to the U.S. is claiming that Obama orchestrated the whole thing, a charge that he will only provide evidence for once Trump is inaugurated. Then finally, we will speak with Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes the daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment. We'll discuss the so-called Shia Crescent as a reality and how much the ground has shifted in the Middle East with the expected victory of the Assad regime in Syria that will mean Iran, through its proxies, will project its power across Iraq and Syria and into Lebanon and right on Israel's doorstep. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. And his latest book is Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And thanks for joining us here on this holiday week, I guess, between Christmas and New Year's. And there is a sense now, as we get ready for the Trump administration coming in on January the 20th, that there's already indications that they're going to have some different ground rules for the press, particularly the White House press corps. So far, he's not allowed them to sort of follow him around in the way that they've been used to and cover things the way they've been used to. Very little of him now. Of course, it's a transition period. Probably it's better that he lays low. But this is the problem that I have, is that this is a man who got elected in part with the help of $5 billion worth of free press and spent most of the campaign castigating the press, blaming them, even corralling them in pens and sicking his very vociferous and sometimes violent supporters on the press. And he seems to have a fairly litigious attitude to the press. So I'm just wondering, since he's already changed the rules and that essentially got the press to play by his rules, do you think this is going to continue, that essentially Trump and Bannon and company will rewrite the rules of covering the White House?
I think they're going to try. I mean, there's no reason for Trump and his people to change tactics. It worked for them. He got them elected president. And they have shown great defiance in their insistence of changing the rules in a way no president previously ever has. And this is going to test the news media in a way it hasn't been tested, certainly since the days of Richard Nixon. But even under Nixon, who hated the media, he wasn't talking about doing these kinds of things Trump did, at least not publicly. So you know, and there's this sort of irony that even while Trump tries to cut them off and weaken them, they're, you know, particularly the television and cable news are so heavily dependent on Trump for their ratings. So I think you're also going to see a divide within the press between the sort of serious print journalists who try to do watchdog reporting and the cable news outlets that really more than anything just want access.
But Trump has not had a press conference, I think, for over 6 to 8 months. I can't even remember the last time he had one. And he's certainly not disposed to having them. And Obama's been having has them fairly regularly, and so did George W. Bush. And so they're already – he's not, you know, playing by the old rules. I mean, let's just start with the press conference issue. Do you think he's going to have press conferences?
I think he'll have as few of them as possible. I mean, again, there's no incentive for him to do it. He got elected by defying the rules. Reporters are unwieldy and uncontrollable. And if he can, govern by tweet, at least in terms of his public image, he will. I think we're going to see very few news conferences because he can't control it. And he'll dole out, the occasional interview to supportive journalists, Sean Hannity and people like that. But I don't think he's going to put himself up for rigorous cross-examination.
Well, he already does that. He only goes on Fox because he knows he's guaranteed the softball.
Right.
Questions, if not adulation.
That's right.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. And his latest book is Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. So not only have the press not been able to get him to have press conferences. They were never able to get him to release his tax forms. They gave him enormous amounts of free media. But just in terms of how they've previous presidents and presidential candidates have been treated and been forced to let the public know who they are and what they stand for and perhaps what their skeletons in their closet are. None of this has happened with Trump, except for the video that was released of him talking about groping women, etc. But, for example, you recall how much Bill Clinton got into trouble over his service in Vietnam, or lack of it, and the same with George W. Bush. Have you noticed that anybody in the press ever asked Donald Trump about why he didn't serve in Vietnam?
There was I can't think of any. I mean, there was a brief little discussion of it during the primaries about, his bone spur in the foot keeping him out. But you're right. I mean, compared to Clinton's, draft dodging and Bush's National Guard service, the attention's been minuscule.
What explains that?
That's a great question. I think part of it is, the press is kind of bifurcated right now. You have serious journalists who are doing investigating, and there are so many other more target-rich environments to investigate with Trump that I think, the draft dodging, if you will, is easy to miss. And then, you have the cable news are active enablers, really, of Trump, and have seen their profits soar as their ratings soar because he's been so controversial and has so many supporters or haters, but people tune in.
Well, but he's also indicated that he'd like to sue the press when he doesn't. And in fact, he was even talking about suing the New York Times over getting those what little information we got about his tax returns. So he's quite litigious, and my sense is that what he's going to do. I know there's such a thing as the First Amendment. It's going to be pretty hard to get around that, but it doesn't mean people haven't tried. Obviously, libel laws are not like they are in the UK. But do you think he could get somewhere by dealing with the lawyers, the suits in the tops of the networks, threatening them, and then they sort of put constraints on their reporters? Is that how much can he get away with intimidating the press with the threat of lawsuits?
Because his wife. That's a great question. I think it's going to be hard. He's talked about changing the libel laws so that it's easier to sue the media and win money, as he put it. That's going to be hard, but not impossible for him to do. I mean, the New York Times, you know, has a famous legal case from 1964 that pretty much set this robust interpretation of libel laws that give the media enormous latitude when it comes to investigating public figures. So for him to have that overturned, he'd have to probably work in concert with a conservative legal establishment, bring a test case that's good, and, you know, have gotten the Supreme Court, a number of justices on the court that would go with him. Although even some of the conservatives are not that sympathetic to him on this, on the court. So I think that's going to be hard. But I think he's going to have more success when it comes to intimidating especially the network news executives. Nixon tried to do that and, you know, had some degree of success. But he was far less, in your face about it than Trump. And, you know, television network news executives are a timorous lot, and they work for, you know, corporations that have a lot of other far-flung interests. So they are really loath to rock the boat. And if Trump, throws his weight around, which seems probable, I think they're going to react negatively, and they're likely to capitulate.
Well, he's got these good surrogates. I mean, this Kellyanne Conway, he obviously deploys her as much as he can because she just absolutely is a brilliant propagandist and can deflect stuff, and he can't. Obviously, he doesn't know very much. So if he had a real press conference, I don't think suddenly the emperor would have no clothes. So that's at the heart of this is disguising the fact that his own inadequacy. But he's also been very clever at playing one network off against another. When he first attacked Megyn Kelly in the earlier Republican primary debates, Fox News didn't defend her so much because Trump suddenly went to CNN and wouldn't go on Fox, and eventually Roger Ailes had to beg him. He hung her out to dry in order to get Trump back because he needed the ratings. So, can you ration the presidency and access that I'm the president, I'm the star? I mean, my sense is that he's probably going to give everything funnel everything through Breitbart and Bannon's people. But do you think he's got a lot of leverage there in terms of, because he only ever appears on Fox now. So will the others come begging like they have before?
I think he does have some leverage because the others want him badly. And while they can, use excerpts that run on Fox, there are, there's a limited amount of that they can do. So I think he wields a real, carrot and stick when it comes to television news because they are so dependent on ratings and profits and because he generates such ratings. If they capitulated on Megyn Kelly, you can expect, more of that kind of behavior. I mean, again, he's only been rewarded for it, so there's no reason to stop, and there's every incentive to continue, if not escalate.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, with the phenomenon of fake news, and we know what happened with and it was a brilliant move on Breitbart's part. You know, he's on the board of Cambridge Analytics, and they did the data mining for Facebook that helped them win Brexit. That was a test run, and then they did the same thing with the Trump campaign, spent much less than Hillary Clinton. But they intimidated Facebook initially by accusing them of having a liberal bias, and then Zuckerberg folded and got rid of the human curation of the news, and then brought in algorithms, and Bannon and company were ready to game the algorithms with fake news. So they've used fake news very effectively. My concern is that these guys are so deeply cynical, and they seem to know all of the tools in both Joseph Goebbels and George Orwell's toolbox.
You know, I mean, the fake news, working the refs was the expression always used, and it's a classic negotiating ploy. You demand a lot more and complain vigorously over almost nothing, because even if they meet you only halfway, you're still going to be better off than you were before. And so, Trump is a professional negotiator, and, no matter what you give him, he's going to demand more. And he does, sort of exercise the whip hand over the media in ways that really are going to test the media in ways they haven't been tested. And I think really are going to test a lot of branches of the government and the Constitution, even in ways they haven't been tested.
But the cynicism of being able to use fake news would indicate to me, a very deep understanding of Orwell and also of Goebbels. And if it's worked once, how long can they? Because it feels like what we're going to have is government by stunt. He's going to pull off these stunts like he did with Carrier and these other stunts. At the same time, he got a billionaire cabinet, and yet you're supposed to be a populist. The whole thing feels like a huge fraud to me. So I'm not looking forward to it, but I'm expecting 4 years of propaganda, no substance, bait and switch, bread and circuses, but essentially propaganda.
Well, and this is bread and circuses, and this is what's going to test the news media, particularly television, because they are so rewarded financially for playing along with that. And the real question is, are they going to hold them accountable? Are they going to look at the policies? Are they going to look at what happens to people who lose their health insurance if Obamacare is in fact repealed? Are they going to look at critically at all of the sort of deep ramifications of the policy decisions he makes? And Lord help us if there's a terrorist attack under his watch, because then whatever powers he has expand exponentially.
Well, just in closing, the reason I'm talking about how clever they are with fake news and why it works, Trump has been out there saying what a great victory, how he won, and record victory and all this stuff. It turns out that 52% of Republicans believe that Trump won the popular vote. And we know that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by almost 3 million. So it works.
It is the big lie.
It works.
Yes, it did, and it worked in 1930s Germany, and he's had some success with it so far here. And the question is, will it catch up with him? Will the news media do its job? Will the other? Will the Constitution work to check that kind of thing here? We don't know the answer. That's the scary part.
Well, Mark Feldstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, I guess. although somewhat depressing, too.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor and the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investor correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. And his latest book is Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the fallout from the recent diplomatic upset Israel suffered at the UN Security Council. And joining us now is Shibli Tlahami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and recently was a senior advisor to the State Department on Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. He is the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, and his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Thank you for joining us, Shibli Tlahami.
Sure. My pleasure.
And as the Obama administration ends up in its last month in office, they've certainly shaken up things at the UN for the first time, I think, ever. The U.S. Has voted, actually abstained, but essentially didn't protect Israel with the normal veto process. But in trying to follow what's happening in Israel, and there's a great deal of anxiety, apparently, that Secretary of State John Kerry is about to give another speech as well, following up on this situation. What's your understanding of why it is that nobody in Israel, at least in terms of the people that you see speaking on behalf of Israel, mentioned the fact of Israel's growing isolation in the world?
Well, it's fascinating because I think they have been pretending like there is no isolation because of the occupation. I mean, if you've looked at the discourse within Israel, which I follow very closely, they're celebrating the fact that the occupation of the West Bank is no longer seen as a big problem for improving relations, even with the Arab states. So if you look at the discourse just in the past year alone, you will find the Israelis talking about how they've managed to improve relations with the Gulf Arab states behind the scenes, that they're moving forward, that they're making contacts, that they're coordinating strategically. And the prime minister himself has improved personally, focused on reviving relations with Africa, providing some new aid to certain African countries, building diplomatic relations. So at some level, they were arguing that actually they're not being isolated, even though as the Europeans were growing more angry on settlements. And there were signs, based on the polling, especially ones that I conduct, that Democrats in this country are very angry about Israeli settlements. So you can see how sort of contradictory this is, because it so happens that the African countries who voted for the resolution have incurred anger of the Israeli prime minister to the point of wanting to take measures against them, including most recently cutting aid to Angola, a country that they've helped build relations with. So it is, at some level, I think it's a disconnect because even with the Obama administration, how would you describe the relationship? But at some level, despite all of the rhetoric and the anger, up until this vote at the UN for 8 years, essentially, the Obama administration has been very friendly at the practical level. What is the practical level? We're providing more strategic aid to Israel than any other administration in the past, despite all of the tension over issues like the settlement issue and the Iran issue. So at some level, there's been a lot of support even here, and that's where the contradictions come. So I can't say that they should have been surprised by this vote. I mean, this is something That's been on the table for a long time. Everyone understood that the Obama administration was going to try to do something in the transition, whether it would be putting forth its own resolution that would define the parameters of final settlement, or more limited action on settlements, a resolution like this that might even be sponsored by the administration itself. And obviously, the administration ultimately doesn't appear to have opted for a parameters of resolution. One is not likely to come in the next couple of weeks. And they had an opportunity to vote on a resolution instead of craft their own on settlements. And it was improbable that they would have vetoed it. It was improbable because this went against everything that the president had said and done over the past 8 years. In a way, his legacy would have been a disastrous legacy for Israel-Palestine because he may have gone down the record as the president who ultimately put the nail in the coffin of the two-state solution, because essentially coming into office in 2009, he said this is a priority for him. He appointed a special envoy in George Mitchell, whom I had the pleasure of advising at that time, and clearly believed that time is running out on the two-state solution. Well, instead, 8 years had been more settlement building and less diplomacy, and ultimately, essentially, bought more time for the expansion settlement, which undermined the two-state solution. So he risked essentially leaving a legacy that was exactly the opposite of what he intended when he came in. And when this resolution, this opportunity came up, it was a minimal gesture to reinforce the opposition to settlements that is felt not only by the U.S., but globally. I mean, the fact is, the only thing that has been standing between the U.N. passing a resolution of this sort is an American veto. And so the fact is, the American abstention enabled it to pass 14-0. So it should not have been as a shock. I don't think the Israelis were shocked. I think they're reacting for other reasons.
And again, I'm speaking with Shibli Talhami. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and was recently a senior advisor to the State Department on Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, and is the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East. And his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. There's talk coming from Israel and from the U.S., their ambassador here in the United States, saying that we have evidence and we're going to present it to the new administration that it's very clear that the U.S. orchestrated this vote, and they're holding President Obama responsible for orchestrating this vote. And of course, as we know, they lobbied hard against it, the Israelis. They lobbied on Netanyahu, got the Egyptians to withdraw the resolution, but then they were outmaneuvered at the UN. New Zealand, Venezuela, Senegal, and Malaysia resubmitted the proposal. And as we know, for the first time ever, the U.S. abstained. And this has gotten Netanyahu absolutely furious. So what is this talk about? Obama, you know, the smoking gun, as far as Netanyahu is concerned, is that this whole thing was orchestrated by Obama. And I mean, it's clearly...
Well, you know, look, let's put it this way. I mean, it's obvious the problem isn't the fact that you have a UN resolution condemning settlements. They've been condemned in the past. Every American administration had opposed them. The UN had declared them illegal in the past. Everyone in the global community pretty much, you know, with very few exceptions, see them as an obstacle to peace and illegal. So the problem isn't that the president of the U.S. abstains from a resolution that is very much in harmony with the declared position on settlements. The problem is settlements itself. And obviously, there is an attempt here to kind of, you know, turn the blame on the president himself for something that he did. But I think it's a little bit more than that. I understand here something a little bit bigger for the Israelis. And the something that's bigger is that they've obviously been accustomed to depend on the U.S. opposing any resolution that opposes them, even one that in principle America has agreed on, but just because the Israelis have not wanted it to pass, the U.S. has been there for them, with very few exceptions, particularly 1980 when another resolution, Jimmy Carter era, actually even, Jimmy Carter era was passed in 1980. But the reality of it is, in this particular case, what you have is something different. You had the day before this resolution came up, the Egyptians had proposed it. It was going to be voted on. It was clear that it would have passed, and it was clear the U.S. was going to abstain. So the Israeli prime minister, brilliantly, I would say, I mean, he did something really quite amazing, given how much support there was for the resolution internationally, even here in the Obama administration, that he orchestrated opposition and a campaign to pressure the Egyptians to withdraw it. And he managed to do so. The fact is, he managed to persuade President-elect Trump to call the prime minister, the president of Egypt, and to ask him to pull out. And lo and behold, the Egyptians agreed. And it looked like it was a brilliant victory the day before. And then the next day, it turns out that other countries are putting this forth. And it rendered the deal that was made between Trump and Sisi, useless. And even the Egyptians ultimately were forced to vote for it. So what looked like a brilliant diplomatic success the day before turned into a diplomatic disaster the next day. And so that there's a level of frustration here that is showing. And there's also a level of frustration in the relationship with Obama. Obviously, it's clear that from day one, the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama has been very difficult, rocky, really, over the years, and certainly was very contentious over the Iran deal when the Prime Minister of Israel came to Congress and gave a speech at a time when the country was heavily polarized, with Republicans mostly opposing the Iran deal and Democrats supporting it. Took what looked like the Republican side at that time, very contentious. And now this action, the anger is boiling over, so you find that being a factor. And finally, I think, the Prime Minister Israel doesn't look good politically on this issue, so he's getting hammered by the opposition for failing diplomatically. It's seen as a diplomatic failure. So he's going on the attack in part to show that he can fight this. And finally, I think it's a preemptive strike in some ways for the next administration. He knows that Trump is far more sympathetic with settlements, at least what we hear from Trump and his advisors on this issue, expecting a different relationship. If Obama, even as he's leaving office, is paying such a price in terms of the pressure and the attacks that are coming on him, it's a little bit of preemption against others who might, including Congress, who might move in that direction. So I don't think it's so much a surprise as much as a political maneuvering at this stage to limit the damage of the deal.
Well, but the way it seems to be being argued in Israel and here in the United States in terms of supporters of Israel is that this is a personal slight. This is a last-minute screw-you kind of gesture on the part of Obama, and that it's really petty and personal. And that seems to distract everybody from the reality of the growing isolation of Israel. As you pointed out, Shibli Tilhami, the Europeans have pretty much given up on Israel a long time ago, and it seems logical to assume that eventually the American people will give up on them too.
I don't think it's giving up on Israel. I think what you find, look, there's still continued support in this country for Israel, and even in Europe, there's continued support for Israel. And the Europeans were careful too, and the UN resolution was careful to differentiate between settlements on the one hand, occupation on the one hand, support for Israel on the other. So, people don't want to, They want clarity. Yeah, we support Israel, but we don't support the continuation of the occupation. Yeah, we support Israel, but we don't support the settlements that are undermining the two-state solution, also illegal in international eyes. And so so that's a message that obviously a lot of people are getting, but some people are not. I mean, you look at the obviously the liberal and the left, the left in Israel is getting it. The center is partly getting it, but is fearful of taking a position publicly on the UN resolution because they see it as strategically detrimental. In the U.S. too, when you say support of Israel, it depends who you're talking about, obviously, but certainly some of the groups that are supportive of Israel have supported the resolution, not a lot of them, but a few. So there is a divide on this issue, and I think this whole exercise of lashing out really, unfortunately, also kind of blurs these differences that are important to keep in mind.
Well, but let's face it, the U.S. and its leaders have made huge investments in trying to bring about peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It was the last thing that Clinton tried to do, and he got very close to it. And the investments are huge. And Obama, as you pointed out, also wanted to do it. Bush didn't seem to show much interest. But the long and the short of it is, if you look at the overall record of U.S. Diplomatic engagement in the world, no other country on the face of the earth has gotten more attention than Israel. It's a tiny little country, but it gets massive, massive attention. And that's the proportionality that I'm talking about. Nobody's suggesting that there's any comparison. I mean, Israel is a democracy. There's no, you can't name an Arab country that's not in complete disarray or has major, major problems and has appalling leadership. But what I'm suggesting here is that what does the U.S. get out of its relationship and this assumption that the U.S. just simply has to go along with Israel, and when they don't over an issue that has been American policy forever, the way it's being discussed in the press is that somehow, you know, this is an act of pettiness on the part of Obama.
Let me just say this here, and this is something, you know, that should be in a way understood in terms of where America stands on these issues. Now, one reason why the Prime Minister of Israel can be so confrontational and angry with the President of the United States is that he and the Israeli government is separate from the principle of supporting Israel, whatever that means, gets support from Congress, strong support, certainly strong support from the Republican side for a lot of reasons, but even many Democrats obviously end up supporting Israel on issues like this. Senator Schumer, for example, who urged Obama to veto the resolution. So you have this reservoir of support in Congress is one reason why the Prime Minister can do this. And second, in this particular case, specifically in the transition, he also knows that the next president at least has taken a different position on those issues. You know, obviously he's unpredictable. We don't know exactly, we don't know where he's going to be, but at least the assumption is he's going to be far more supportive of Israel. So the Prime Minister of Israel can decide that. But at the public level, something profound has happened, and the polls have been showing it, and it is something that needs to be understood, and that is that the country is deeply divided on Israel, particularly on settlements, deeply divided on settlements. So what the president did is supported by a plurality of Americans, according to the poll I did after the election, and B, by a large majority of Democrats, 65%. So what the president did is actually in harmony with the Democratic constituency. There's nothing there that is going to anger Democrats. Some Democrats may think he didn't do enough. And for one thing, on the settlement issue specifically, in my most recent poll, which was conducted after the election, now we have 60% of Democrats who want to see some sanctions or more serious measures imposed over the settlement issues. So it's something that the president is nowhere near. This resolution has no teeth to it. And so in some ways, yes, America is divided along partisan lines on almost on every issue, but including on this one that used to be a bipartisan issue, but not so much Congress. And that's where the power structure is. You know, we talk about the establishment through the rank and file. On this issue, there's a big gap between the Democrats' constituency and congressional leaders. And there is less of a gap between Republican constituency and Republican leaders.
And indeed, I'm sure there'll be a counterattack through the Congress against on the part of Netanyahu. The game is not over, I'm afraid. And I've been speaking with Shibley Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and was recently a senior advisor to the State Department on Palestinian-Israeli negotiations and is the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East. And his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the so-called Shia Crescent as a reality. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
Well, thanks for having me on. A pleasure.
Thank you, Joshua. And on Christmas Day, the Pope Francis called for an end to the fighting in Syria in his Christmas address at the Vatican. And far too much blood has been spilled, he said, and that the world community has to actively seek a negotiated solution to the 5-year war going on 6 years. Obviously, I think we all feel that way, and this sense of helplessness, particularly in the White House, where the president, on many occasions, has said he's found this whole situation agonizing, but yet nothing has been done, and of course he's getting a lot of criticism for it. Iran, through its proxies, controls essentially Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
Absolutely. And that there's a new security architecture that has been, in a sense, put in place over the last number of years, in which Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Assad regime, which looked like it might be overthrown, and a Sunni hegemony that would be allied with Saudi Arabia and Turkey take its place, but that was thwarted through the help of Iran, Hezbollah, Iraqi militias. All of these essentially Shiite militias poured into Syria to help Assad regime recoup its position. And Russia, of course, jumped in as well. This, you know, Russia plays a big part in that. But in Iraq, it's been the United States, of course, which dislodged the Sunnis from power and helped build a Shiite-dominated state. That may not have been the intention of the United States when they invaded to overthrow Saddam Hussein in 2003. Certainly, they intended to put the Shiites in a dominant position because Shiites make up 60% of the population of Iraq, but that's what they've done. And in a sense, the United States has been the handmaiden to spreading Iranian power in Iran. I mean, excuse me, Iranian power in Iraq and throughout this entire Shiite crescent to a certain degree, because the United States, although it claims to want to isolate and contain Iran, it expresses in its talking points that it sees Iran as an aggressive and a malevolent power. At the same time, its military solution for Iraq and, in a sense, Syria has been to help Iranian militias and the Iranian build an Iranian army dominated by Shiites to take over. And that has helped Iran immensely.
So the U.S. clearly has a confused and schizophrenic policy here, because on the one hand, in Iraq, effectively, the United States is the air force for the Iraqi Shiites and the Iranians against the Islamic State, a Sunni organization. But in next door in Syria, they're actually helping the Russians, in effect, and they're the air force for Assad, who they oppose, to bomb the Islamic State in Syria. So that's something that we've never been able to sort of reconcile, I don't think. But what about the new incoming administration? It seems to also have something along the lines of a schizophrenic policy, because on the one hand, they don't like Iran, but on the other hand, they don't seem to be – they like Russia, and they don't seem to be bothered by the idea of a Russian victory, which also is an Iranian victory in Syria.
That's true. The United States, in a sense, started off on an errand, which was to help Sunni rebels in Syria overthrow the Assad regime, which had been a thorn in the side of the United States for decades. It had been anti-Israel. It had helped Hezbollah. It had not wanted the United States to overthrow Saddam Hussein and to occupy Iraq. So Syria had been against many principal American policies in the Middle East. So we wanted to get rid of Assad. The trouble is, once we began to fire up and support these militias, there was a powerful Salafist and jihadist wing of these Sunni militias that became the dominant force. So we discovered that in our ambition to help Sunni moderates, which we thought would predominate, we got it wrong. And in fact, more radicals predominated. And we ultimately, most of the arms that we pushed into Syria towards moderates were captured by extremists. And that meant that the United States turned away from the rebel cause and increasingly allowed Russia to prop up Assad. And we did nothing to undermine Assad. We began to focus on a very narrow policy of attacking ISIS, which we saw as extremist fundamentalists we wanted to destroy. But by attacking ISIS, in a sense, we were taking the pressure off of Assad, because Assad was one of ISIS's main enemies, and ISIS began to take a lot of his territory. So eventually, you know, in the last 5 years, America has moved away from helping the rebels and is now flying to pound ISIS, which ultimately is going to help Assad retake eastern Syria, as far as I can tell. And Russia has been pounding the other rebels, which is helping Assad recoup and reestablish his authority over Syria. And in a sense, I mean, if you want to, the Sunni rebels, both in Iraq and in Syria, have become more radicalized. And that meant that America ultimately has turned against them and has seen the spread of the Shiite crescent in a way as a way to contain Sunni radicalism. And that has played into the hands of Iran and Hezbollah and Assad regime and Russia, which is going to be a major benefactor of this new security architecture that's pro-Iranian and pro-Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. So in terms of our confusion, and as I refer to it as kind of schizophrenic policy, and there's some confusion with the new administration, which is appears to be both pro-Russia and anti-Iran, when in fact Iran and Russia are on the same page in Syria. But let's go back to the original sin, if you will, which is the invasion of Iraq, where the only winners of the Iraq war so far have been Iran, and effectively Bush, Cheney, Rice, and Rumsfeld handed over Iraq to Iran. And they were supported by the neoconservatives, who were big supporters of the Israeli Likud right wing. And my sense is that isn't that a major irony now that you eventually, we know that Iran is the mortal enemy of Netanyahu, and yet U.S. policy has eventually brought Iran right to Israel's doorstep in Lebanon.
Yes, and in Syria. And this is, you know, this is the conundrum for Israel. Israel supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq, thinking that getting rid of Saddam Hussein would alleviate their major Arab enemy. The trouble is, it empowered Iran, which now is seen as the major enemy of Israel. And of course, Iran is a much bigger country than Iraq. It's much more technologically advanced. It was developing nuclear capabilities. And Israel looked to the United States to contain Iran. But now that Iran has, in a sense, gotten out of its box and broken out of isolation, and it has ensconced its power throughout the Middle East in places like Syria, Lebanon with Hezbollah, Iraq, and now, of course, it's being accused of spreading in the Gulf, where there are many downtrodden Shiite populations, whether it's in Yemen or in Bahrain. And Saudi Arabia and America's allies are very worried that Iran will fish in these troubled waters in order to empower aggrieved Shiite populations to try to get equality and perhaps even a share of power.
So is it possible then that under this new regime, I'm talking about Trump, Tillerson, Flynn and company, that they may make a big deal with Russia, which in a way might mirror what Nixon did, with the difference being that this would be a U.S.-Russian alliance against China, and they may make an alliance as well with this Shia, as Russia has already done in effect with Iran, against Sunni extremism, which comes largely, at least in terms of its inspiration, comes from Saudi Arabia. So when you talk about these new alignments, you've got the Shia crescent now, Iran through its proxies controlling Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Israel is getting closer to Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Will the U.S., do you think, through if this initiative with Russia goes forward, will they cut Saudi Arabia loose, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think Saudi Arabia is fundamentally important to the U.S. And in a sense, what we've been seeing is the U.S. consolidating its interests in the Middle East to the southern part of the Middle East. That means the Gulf states, which have so much oil. The United States wants to keep its hand on the spigot, the Persian Gulf, and remain the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, where we have, you know, ships and important ports, because that's the way the world gets their oil and their energy supplies. And so long as we are the dominant power in the Persian Gulf and can control the flow of oil to the world, China and other growing powers will have to respect America. They'll have to look to America without challenging it too much. And even as we see China spread its wings in the South China Sea and push back against the United States, we can be fairly confident that they won't become too aggressive so long as we dominate this oil-rich part of the world. And America's superpower status in some ways is connected to its military power in the Persian Gulf. So I doubt that we will cut Saudi Arabia loose. We are wedded to Saudi Arabia, like it or not, and we have been very careful about criticizing Saudi spread of fundamentalist ideology, Wahhabism, its school network around the world, which has, to a certain extent, been guilty of spreading the kind of Salafist ideology that underpins radical Islam. But there's very little we can do to force Saudi Arabia to change that without undermining this essential relationship in the Persian Gulf.
Well, if indeed Trump and Tillerson can and Putin can work together to develop the Siberian oil and gas, then you could have a situation where Russia could become the major energy supplier of Japan, South Korea, and China, and have the same relationship in effect that Gazprom and Russia and Putin have over Western Europe, where they've got a certain amount of leverage because they depend Western Europe depends on Russian gas. That's not happening right away. That's why I brought up the idea of a sort of new version of Nixon's triangulation. Because it makes sense to, why ship all that oil all that way across the Indian Ocean up through the Straits of Malacca to the Asian markets when right next door you could get it from Russia?
Right. Well, that is true. And you can get it from Iran and you can get it from a number of other places. I think China is trying to diversify as much as they can. About 20% of China's oil and energy is imported from Iran. Saudi Arabia is a major player in the China market. I think China wants to keep as diverse a supply chain as they can in order not to be dependent on any one country. Now, the chance of the United States really moving closer to Russia seems to me to be very limited. I think that Trump will find that his hands are tied on this issue. Enmity towards Russia and a Russia ruled by a strong man such as Putin is very powerful. The competition between the United States and Russia is powerful. We may close our eyes in a country like Syria to Russia's role because we see it in some ways helping us. It's anti-ISIS. It's propping up a state which we see as less bad than a fundamentalist alternative. And we don't have big interest in Syria. We don't want to get involved and get sucked into Syria. So in a sense, we're ceding it to Russia. But I don't think that that's going to be a pillar upon which we'll have a lot of a constructive relationship. To a certain degree, we may turn our back.
When the Soviets were taking over big chunks of Africa and Angola, Ethiopia, etc., there was all this panic about the Russians taking over the world. And some of the smarter people said, well, this is what you called strategic indigestion. You know, let the Russians take over as much of the world as they can because they're just going to eventually bring them down because they can't, you know, it's an empire where periphery has a higher standard of living than the home country. It's doomed to fail, and nobody, of course, was smart enough to see that, and that's eventually what happened to the Russians. Could the same thing happen to Iran? It's swallowing up all these responsibilities in Iraq. Syria is devastated. I mean, it's going to cost them a fortune to put that place back together.
It will.
And Lebanon's a mess, too. So what's your, just in closing, could they suffer from strategic indigestion with the new Shia crescent?
The Middle Eastern world has been thrown into tumult by the spread of Iranian power and the ability of the Iranians to empower the Shiite communities sprinkled across the Middle East that have always been, in a sense, the dirt farmers, the underprivileged, and discriminated against. And so this has thrown the Middle East into chaos. Iran is exploiting it like mad to spread its influence. But Arabs are going to have to find a new way of relating to each other and looking across this religious divide that doesn't threaten them so that they can accommodate both Shiism and Sunnism on a equal playing field and as partners, equal religions. And that's a difficult transition to make. It was very difficult for Protestants and Catholics to share Europe. It's going to be difficult for Shiites and Sunnis to share the Middle East.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics.